Hello and welcome to episode 116 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. Bill, how are we today?
Well, I got a bit of a sore throat today, Seth, so I may not say much, but Guadalcanal is near and dear to my heart. My great uncle was there, actually with the Army, following the Marines as a combat engineer. So I've heard Guadalcanal stories since I was a child.
Same here. This week, we would like to welcome back Dave Holland. Dave is just to reintroduce Dave. Dave is a former United States Marine. He owns and runs the Facebook and YouTube channel called Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield. He's a Solomon Islands battlefield guide and, most importantly, a Guadalcanal expert. Welcome back, Dave. How you doing, man?
I'm doing well, and thanks for having me back. I really enjoyed our talk last week and looking forward to this one.
Absolutely. This is a very important one here. They all are, but this is very important. So to set the stage of where we are, it's been over a month since the Marines landed on Guadalcanal, Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanimbogo. August has passed, and with it, the lives of over 1,200 Allied sailors and airmen at the battles of Savo Island and Eastern Solomons, as well as the lives of over 200 U.S. Marines ashore. The Japanese have lost over 1,700 men ashore on the aforementioned islands, including nearly 800 at the Tenaru River on August 21st, as well as nearly 300 lost at sea. Operation Watchtower was never assumed that it would be a quick in-and-out operation. It was never thought of, at least by the United States, as a quick trip. The Americans knew it would be a slugfest. How much of a slugfest, however, was anyone's guess. As September dawned and the first week passed, the slugfest ashore abruptly turned into a meat grinder. A bloody, drawn-out campaign of attrition was something that the Japanese could not withstand. The Japanese were sick of the Marines on Guadalcanal and wanted them out, and wanted them out now. Beginning in the first week of September, over 5,000 Japanese troops under the command of General Kawaguchi landed on Guadalcanal, with their sole mission being to, quote, rout and annihilate the enemy in the vicinity of Guadalcanal Island airfield, end quote. The focus of their initial assaults on the Marines in September would center on an area just south of Henderson Field, near three small hills and an as yet unnamed ridge. The unnamed ridge would soon receive several names from the Marines who defended it, but history would call it Edson's Ridge. So let's lead up to this momentous event in the history of Guadalcanal, which I know we all have our differing opinions as what's probably the most climactic battle of the campaign. I have personally viewed this as being certainly probably the nastiest and the closest, and we'll get to the detail. But Dave, there are several events that lead up to the fighting at Edson's Ridge. How do we get here? How do we get there?
Yes, I don't know how far back you want me to go.
Let's talk about, you know, we'll go back. So the Imperial Japanese Army, you know, obviously, as soon as we landed on Guadalcanal and they realized that, hey, this isn't a raid, you know, we want to get these pests off this island so we can continue our job here. I found that as early as August 18th, which is, you know, just a little over 10 days after the landings on Guadalcanal, the Imperial Japanese Army had decided that they were going to send a large force to the island. This is, of course, you know, before Tenaru River, just a few days and all that jazz, but to kick the Marines out of here. This is going to be General Kawaguchi's people. He'd actually already been selected to do this job. Excuse me. And by late August, Kawaguchi, after he had been selected to lead this force, he'd already formed a plan to go to Guadalcanal and kick the Marines out of here. He kind of had a weird way of getting people to Guadalcanal. And we kind of talked about this before via email, you and I, before, but like the barges and fast destroyers, he had multiple ways of getting people there.
Yeah, I can talk about that. So Kawaguchi was the major general in command of the 35th Brigade, which was the Kawaguchi Brigade, centered around the 124th Japanese Infantry Regiment, with a number of field guns and other support units, like water purification units, and all kind of weird names some of the Japanese units had. But these guys were veterans of Borneo. They were part of the initially South Seas Detachment, and they were slated to become part of the 17th Army under Hai Kotaki, the Japanese general based out of Rabaul. they were going to go into initially they were centered to go in to reinforce the Japanese in Kokoda on a Kokoda track or trail.
Dave, were these guys also China veterans?
I don't know. Maybe some of the NCOs were, but the actual brigade, starting from obviously when the U.S. coming into the war in December 41, they landed in Borneo and some of the other Dutch East Indies as a whole unit. So they were veterans. And going back to the barge, barges reference, Kawaguchi, when he invaded Borneo and the Dutch East Indies, they used barges. So they got around on the barges quite a bit. So he was used to the barges, and that was his plan. That's how we're going to get to Guadalcanal. We're going to use barges. So instead of going to New Guinea, these guys were diverted to take out the Marines there. And once they did that, then obviously the focus was going to be back on Port Moresby. At this time, the objective was Port Moresby for the Japanese. And this is before the Battle of Bloody Ridge or Edson's Ridge. So Kawaguchi, he's pressing for the barges, but the Imperial Japanese Navy says, look, they have aircraft on the field, so to speak, and we can't have the barges because they're very slow and they'll be susceptible to air attack during the day. So the theory was, well, what we'll do, we'll send the barges at night, and there's a series of small islands in the Solomon Islands, and we'll just shore up during the day and take a barge position and then slowly make our way down. So they came to the conclusion that, okay, and then we'll send some of the forces by barges. And that was Colonel Oka, who was the commander of the 124th. So him and one battalion and some other elements went by barge, while Kawaguchi and the rest of the brigade went by fast destroyers, DD destroyers. And they landed at a place called Tabu Point. And go ahead.
So, I was going to say, you talk about the fast destroyers. This is not the first, but it's one of the first instances of the Tokyo Express is what the Americans started to call it when they bring in the Japanese reinforcements to the island of Guadalcanal via these fast destroyers. And it's an interesting point in that, you know, if you talk to any Marine who was on the island for any length of time, you know, from August through, let's just say, November, anywhere in that period of time, they all talk about some sort of naval bombardment, you know, from the Japanese. And I know not every time the Japanese brought these troops in via destroyer, but often they'd, you know, drop them off at Taivu Point or what was the other? There was another landing location.
They don't buy it. At Cape Esperance on the other end of the island. Yeah, the northwest corner.
And they'd come and they'd lob a few shells at Henderson Field. And this is, you know, it became, you know, they'd like to say it happened every night. Of course, it didn't happen every night. But if you're getting shot at from naval artillery, it probably felt like it was every night. And but there were several problems with Kawaguchi's plan, not only just to get people to Guadalcanal, like you said, the slow barges, you know, that's just ripe pickings for the SBDs flying off of Henderson Field or the F-4Fs or P-400s even. I mean, just anything. But he had some serious intel issues, too. Or rather, I could say lack thereof. He had lack of intelligence when it came to the strength of the Marines that were there. Now, you know, we talked about in the last time you and I talked, or the three of us talked, that you know, Ichiki kind of had that same sort of problem. But Kawaguchi didn't learn from anything from Ichiki's failure, did he?
Oh, no. They with intel, the Japanese and the U.S. at times, they both had problems with intel. Sure. With estimation and number. So Kawaguchi was under the impression there was still only roughly 2,000 to 3,000 Marines on the island, even though other Japanese officers, some of the other staff officers and some of the naval officers had estimated there was close to 6,000 to 8,000. But Kawaguchi had in his mind, no, there's at least most likely 2,000 to 3,000. They're based over a 5-mile perimeter. So they're spaced out. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same theories that Ichiki had. Just hit him at a fixed point with all we got, and we should be able to punch through.
And while he's probably not far off, and the Marines were stretched rather thin, but they damn sure didn't have 2,000 people there. They had,
well, they had 12,000 actually at that stage on the island. Right. And we're not counting Gavutu and Tanambogo and Tulagi.
There's actually two failures here. The first one is the failure of the intelligence, and the second one is the operational planning that they did, with that assumed more certainty about the enemy disposition than they really had. They should, he should have probed and you know, and determined, confirmed his suspicions before he committed to this course of action. And that's a planning failure, not an intelligence failure.
There's a lot of failures with Kawaguchi's actions, frankly. There are a lot. This is certainly the first, but it damn sure ain't the last. And we'll get to the importance of the failures here in just a few minutes. But one thing that factors very, very heavily into what we're talking about here is that by September the 7th, now he gets, theoretically, he gets his orders in late August. I don't remember the exact day that he gets his orders to get out of here.
Off my head, but no.
Yeah, I don't recall either. However, by September the 7th, he'd had over 5,000 guys, Kawaguchi, that is, had over 5,000 guys transported to Guadalcanal at Taivu Point and around that general vicinity. This did not include, however, Colonel Oka. You mentioned Colonel Oka briefly about the barges. He had somewhat 1,000 guys at this point, and they were separate, and they were slated to hit the American lines at a different location. Can you talk a little bit about Oka?
Yeah, Colonel Oka is kind of he's the bad luck commander of Guadalcanal. He's always turning up. I think he actually survived the campaign, but he's always turning up in all these different battles and doesn't go to his favor. But okay, at this stage, I think I mentioned earlier, he was the commander of the 124th Regiment, the Colonel of the 124th, which is the nucleus of the brigade, of Kawaguchi's brigade. So he was going to land with one battalion of the 124th and some other elements on the eastern side. And then Kawaguchi and the main elements were landing at Taivu Point on the western side, roughly the same area where the Ichiki detachment landed. But this is where a number of factors that we'll later see that factored into the Battle of Edson's Ridge. It went for the Allies' favor. One was the air power. So when Oka was coming down on the slow barges, he was hit by the Cactus Air Force, and a number of his barges were sunk and his men killed or drowned. But he managed to end up landing. And his point and Kawaguchi, there was a plan. The plan looked good, but Kawaguchi was going to basically hit the Marines on both flanks with diversionary attacks, then hit them up from the south from the jungle in a main assault. And Colonel Oka, on the left flank, which would be the western flank, was going to do that diversionary assault. And the right flank was the Kuma Battalion, which was the second echelon of the Ichiki that he was supposed to wait for. They were going to hit the Marines on the Marines' right flank, and probably about 2 miles from the mouth of Alligator Creek. And Kawaguchi had picked this second echelon, the Kuma Battalion, or the Ichiki Detachment, to strike that part of the Marines' lines to, I guess, avenge Ichiki.
Yeah,
which, that was the main plan, and that was where Colonel Oka came in.
Yeah, it kind of goes into that whole thing we talked about the last time we recorded was that, you know, the Japanese spirit, striking over the battleground of their defeated commander to avenge his loss and everything. And that sounds all sexy and pretty and, you know, romantic, but didn't really work out, did it?
But in this case, if you keep losing, sooner or later, you can't blame the enemy anymore. You need to blame yourself, right?
Exactly. Well, especially with the way that they lose here. Yeah.
And doing the same thing over and over and over without learning and being flexible, adaptive. Mm-hmm.
What do they say the definition of insanity is? You know, you ask the same question over and over again and expect to get the same answer. Well, this is kind of the same thing here. Well, getting back to what we were talking about, we talked about the Kuma Battalion. We talked about which is essentially Ichiki. We talked about Oka. But one of Kawaguchi's plans was to separate. You know, you talked about where he wanted them to hit and everything else, but he separated his units into small parcels of men.
Three columns, yes, the main.
Right, right. And then expected them to move through the jungle in unison, essentially, and arrive at their respective points at roughly the same time so they could all launch their attack at the same time, which, again, sounds great. But the Guadalcanal jungle swallowed these men alive and severely, severely. Again, this is Kawaguchi underestimating not only his enemy, but the terrain as well. Can you talk a little bit about the way the Japanese just, you know, botched the whole approach?
Yeah, that's very correct what you said there. It was three columns he divided, and he had three battalions. He had two battalions of the 124th. There was a battalion of the 4th Infantry. I forgot what the AOBA, but they're part of the 2nd Division. And they were the forward element of the 2nd Division because at that stage, Japanese are already going to commit the 2nd Infantry Division to Guadalcanal, so they're the leading element. So they were moving in three columns, and they had faulty maps. Apparently, you read some accounts, their compasses were bad. So I haven't verified that. Speaking from experiences, you've got roughly at that stage, you have 3,000 guys moving south. I don't see 3,000 guys all having faulty compasses. No. You know, some historians said they had faulty compasses. Well, not all. Some would. And I'll put it to some of these guys who never walked in the jungle with a compass before with a large group of guys. But anyway, that's just my theory.
If you're walking, you're not running into the mountains on your right or the ocean to your left, you're going south.
Yeah. But in saying that, I've walked those same jungles. I could put, I actually seen it. I could put 100 guys on one side and go, oh, look, here's a thick jungle.
Yeah.
Okay, you 100 guys stay together. And we're only going to move 200 yards through the jungle and I'll meet you on the other side. And they get all disorientated. Mm-hmm. And this is during the day. I can imagine during the night. It's very easily get disorientated in the jungle. And yeah, they underestimated their terrain, which they did a number of times on Guadalcanal, especially during the October battle. Underestimated the terrain. Contrary to what a lot of people think, or what's the popular belief out there, the Japanese wasn't the great jungle fighters as they're reputed to be and received a lot of jungle training. They were very good. Obviously fighters, and they knew the jungle, but they didn't live in the jungle, so to speak. A lot of them are from the large cities in Tokyo and such. But anyway, yeah, they underestimated the jungle. They got a bit lost. In fact, at one stage, it's like traffic jams. They were supposed to take parallel trails. They're trying to use the existing native trails, and they were just going all over the place, and they were weaving into each other. Massive traffic jams.
Passage of lanes.
Thousands, three columns of 1,000 guys each, and they're just hitting each other. You can just imagine. And you will later see during a battle, there was one battalion that just, instead of going to the American lines, they were going parallel to the American lines. That's how disorientated they were because their commander was lost. But, and the communication, he lost communication, Kawaguchi did, with his three main elements.
Right.
So they were kind of on their own there for a while. But he did have communication with Oka. I found that a bit strange that he couldn't speak to his guys very close to him. He could speak to Oka, which was miles away on the other side of the island. So I haven't really found the evidence how he was able to speak to Oka.
That is odd. Yeah.
Yeah. But all the accounts said he was speaking to Oka, and Oka kept telling him, we're delayed, we're delayed. I mean, he could probably use a form of HF radio or VHF.
Mm-hmm.
Probably HF radio, I imagine, but yeah.
But the bottom line is that the jungle delayed everything that they wanted to do, and not even necessarily. Well, although it did delay their actual launch date for their attack. But the main thing is, as we'll see as we go on, is it delayed the units getting there in strength enough to break the American lines. So the jungle played a huge part in the event that's about to unfold, just as much as Marine machine guns and grenades did, frankly, in my opinion. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about a group of Americans who Vandegrift has moved from Tulagi and Gavutu over to Guadalcanal. And these guys, I mean, this is why it's called Edson's Ridge. These are the First Raider Battalion and what's left of the Paramarines. Once they get to Guadalcanal, they're not there very long before Colonel Merritt Edson, the CUO of the First Raiders, decides to, he gets orders, but conduct a raid on a little village called Tassimboko. And this plays huge into the fight here at Edson's Ridge. Can you lay it on us? What happens at Tassimboko, Dave?
Yeah, so Tassimboko occurred on the 8th of September, 42. So, like you said, Edson had his composite battalion of the Raiders and the Paraguays. So they were given task to do what they were trying to do, do an amphibious assault or amphibious raid. Mm-hmm. So Tavu Point was where Kawaguchi had landed, and Tazimboko was a village not too far from Tavu Point where he established his main supply base. So the local Solomon Islander scouts and some of the Marine intelligence or naval intelligence had said there was a motley crew, as they called it, roughly around 300 Japanese based there. Probably they're thinking they were some of the rear elements of the Ichiki guys, and it would be a quick in and out raid. So once Edson decided to do his raid, so they left on the APDs, which is, as you know, the fast transport. I'm trying to think. They're all four staggered storage, and they took two boilers out, or two staggers, so they could put a lot of Marines on there, which I think a reinforced company size. They can do a fast attack. So they had two of them, and they left in two echelons. So they hit Tavu Point. And when they hit Tavu Point, as soon as they landed with two companies, they noticed there was a number of Japanese life jackets and backpacks and some artillery pieces. Mm-hmm. It looked like a Japanese had just landed, but there's no Japanese there. They thought, also too, I'll backtrack, they were on Yippie boats too. They had some Yippie boats, YP boats. They were converted Japanese fishing trawlers, which if you read anything about the Guadalcanal campaign, these little Yippie boats did a lot of work. Unfortunately, some were sunk, but yeah, the YP boats. That's a good read if you read on those things. But anyway, as soon as they landed, they'd hit some of the, there was an artillery battery of 75 millimeters. It had just been landed Japanese. And that's why they seen the four 75 millimeter howitzers there. Mm-hmm. So the Japanese, as soon as the Japanese seen these Marines landing, at the same time, unknowns to the Marines, it was a U.S. convoy of transports. It was like two or three destroyers and a couple of transports going off the coast, heading to Lunga Point. And the Japanese seen all these ships, and they said, oh, this is a major invasion. So they ran into the jungle. So Marines landed. They moved through. The other contingency landed, and they started moving to Tazimboko village. Once they got to Tazimboko village, the Japanese put up a little bit of a fight. They worked out that, okay, this is not as a major invasion. And they started fighting the Marines. But it was just a short fight. And the Marines were able to, without going into much detail, basically destroy a large part of the Japanese supply that from the 35th Brigade. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of, you read stories about from the American Civil War with Stonewall Jackson with Manassas Junction. When they hit the major Union supply base, they're in there filling their pockets full of food, and they're, you know, gorging themselves out, and they're just having a good time. That's what the raiders did. You know, this whole, and you probably interviewed a number of them where they were putting, you know, cans or tins of Japanese food in their pocket, and, you know, like Japanese sake, and they were just having a good time. In fact, Edson got up and started yelling at them at one stage and had to keep moving them on.
And crab and things like that.
Oh, yeah. You can imagine these guys were starving. They just hit the gold mine, a jackpot. And they were ripping up rice bags and urinating in their bags. And they were towing the artillery pieces out into the ocean and dumping them and things like that. So they basically destroyed and put a major dent in Kawaguchi's plan. And Kawaguchi knew of this. And there's a bit of a theory whether he decided not to go back because he'd already fixated on this attack, or he just didn't get the word in time to go back and fight these Americans off. So Kawaguchi knew of it. He did send a few guys back, but he continued on with his main assault.
And so Tassimboko's on the coast, so the Marines, I know they're going to the jungle, but they're kind of hugging the coast as they do that. Are the Japanese inland at this point?
Yeah, they're inland quite a bit. They're not that inland. They're a bit down the coast. So his plan, Kawaguchi, once we mentioned before, to divide it in three sections. So if we're going to move down the coast, and they're starting to peel off at every river. You know, first group, second group, and third group. The last group was the Kuma Battalion with their artillery, so they were going to be the last group to peel off. They were using the government coastal track as much as they could. Now, Tazimboko, the thing about Tazimboko, once they worked out that there wasn't a motley crew, this intel actually came through when they're in ships about to land. There were probably about, they reckon, 3,000 Japanese there. But Edson said, we're still landing. And once he landed, he started sending reports back. And he says, yes, I think we've confirmed it. There's probably about 3,000 Japanese around here. Vandegrift, the Major General ordered him back. He refused. He said, I'm having bad comms. My communication, you know, the old typical, I can't hear you.
Right.
And that just shows you the aggressive spirit, especially of Edson and the Raiders. At that stage, he probably only had his first echelon, so maybe 400 guys, and he's going up against potentially 3,000. But he didn't care. He said, we're Raiders. We can go in and out. If there's 3,000 here, we'll continue with the fight.
Right.
And well, luckily for him, most of the 3,000 was inland, or
they were gone. Yeah,
and I won't admit ever pretending that I didn't receive the message. Neither confirm nor deny.
Well, just on that real quick, I know we want to get back to the battle, but the famous Marines, Banana War Marines, there, battalion commanders of Puller, mm-hmm. Heineken, and Bill Whaling, all veterans of the Banana Wars. They were known as the Coconut Warriors. And if you read Twining's book, who was the operations officer for division, he said these guys have the bad habit and they were using the old coconut techniques. As soon as they left the front line, all communication stopped.
Right.
Could never get communication with these guys, he said. They just had a bad habit. That was the old thing they used to do in the coconut banana war, so to speak.
So the big thing about Tassimboko, while it lets the Raiders, you know, get in there, and the first Raiders get in there and draw some blood, which is all fine and dandy. You know, they get food, which is a good thing if you're hungry. But as you said, you nailed it when you said there were 75 millimeter artillery pieces there. Edson and his people looked around and said, this is just a lot of Japanese that have been here. They're obviously not here now, but there's a lot has been here. And the signs of the landings, as you said, the life jackets, the, you know, food, the grenades, the aiming, all this stuff, you know, it let him know that there are a lot of people there. But he took that intelligence back, and that is what one of the things that allowed him and Vandegrift to start to prepare for the assault that's going to come. But before we get to that, because this guy features so heavily into everything we're going to talk about for the rest of this day, let's talk about Red Mike. He's the CO, and we touched on him briefly when we talked about Tulagi. Or you did, rather. But Merritt A. Edson, he's known as Red Mike because of his hair, but he's not a red, fiery personality, is he? Can you tell us a little bit about Merritt Edson?
Yeah, Edson, he missed the first war, for the Great War, First World War, just barely missed it, so he didn't get involved in that. But he was very well known in the Marines for his shooting skills, expert marksman. He had some combat action in Nicaragua. I think he earned some of his reputation from Nicaragua. He was known as a very cool, efficient, aggressive leader, very cool under pressure, never showed emotions, very, very hard on his men, but very fair. You probably, when you did some of your interviews with the Raiders, they probably said, look, you know, he's a hard man, but he's fair on us, but don't cross him. But he's very tactically sound.
They loved him. All those guys, they loved him.
Oh, yeah. And Vandegrift, so Edson was one of the young, aggressive commanders that Vandegrift relied on. And you'll see later that he rose very quickly, especially after this battle, and he assumed regimental command. So Edson, he'd done the normal post-war or pre-war things a Marine career officer would do. And then in 1940, he took over command of the 1st Battalion, 5th Marines. And this, to make it a bit short, and long story short, he formed this battalion with H.M. Smith, Hallamad Smith, and Holcomb into the first separate battalion or the first special battalion, they called it, which is they were going to use these guys in amphibious assault raids, more like kind of a commando type unit out of those fast transports. And they basically formed 1-5. Into that battalion, which later gained its name, the 1st Raider Battalion, in 1941, at the time that it decided to form 2 battalions of Raiders. So Edson was their commander. And as we've seen on Tulagi, he was very aggressive and got the job done, so to speak.
He was judged, to pile on what you're saying, he was judged to be an absolute genius when it came to infantry tactics. This is before Edson's Ridge. And the things you'll see, and I mean, you know, he was a leader of men. He was one of those guys that you know, you if you were around him, you know, you just wanted to do things for him, not because necessarily he told you to, but That's just, he had that type of personality. Every single Raider I knew said that, you know, that they knew Edson, and you just wanted to please the man, not because he asked you to. It's just
as a Ranger, as a regiment commander, was he a full colonel?
He was at this time, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He was a full colonel when he landed on Guadalcanal. He got promoted.
Robert. But he had this grasp of being able to judge a situation, a combat situation, within seconds. And deploy or redeploy or what have you, his men, you know, at seemingly at the perfect time, at the perfect place every time. And he does this over and over and over again in a couple of nights. But due to the intel that he get, well, not he gathered, but his raiders gathered there at Tassimboko, this information was able to inform Vandegrift that, yeah, there's a lot of Japanese here. Actually, Edson came back and he says, this is no motley of Japs. When he came back, he said, this is a lot of people here and they're coming. And I think he estimated, like you said, Dave, somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 Japanese. And he was not far off. He was, you know, there were a little under 5, I believe, to be exact. But he picked out, didn't Edson and Vandegrift themselves, he looked at a map of Guadalcanal, and or an aerial photograph rather, and he looked at the spiny track right there of what would be called Edson's Ridge, and says, this is probably where they're gonna hit, and we probably ought to put our people there.
Yeah, I mean, the Japanese had knew of that ridge from the aerial photographs, and if you look at it, it's a quick, it's a clear delineal feature that runs north and south, and it's almost like a line of the jungle straight to the airfield. Mm-hmm. So if you move in a large group of troops, especially out of that jungle, and if they could hit that, it's almost like a highway to the airfield. Once you hit that clear delineal path, unobstructed, you can move them very quickly in a fixed point. It's almost made for attack on the airfield. So Vandegrift was very reluctant to think the Japanese were going to attack there. So his chief of staff was Thomas. So it was Thomas and Edson who's trying to convince Vandegrift. So Vandegrift at that stage had his division command posts, a place called Lunga Ridge. And sometimes Edson's Ridge gets confused with Lunga Ridge, but Lunga Ridge is actually probably about a mile, maybe 2 miles, a bit northwest on the Lunga River, right by the airfield. So that's where Vandegrift had his division CP. It was behind that ridge. It shielded him from direct fire. But unfortunately, he was in, they call it the V-ring, which is the bullseye of the daily bombing raids. So he wanted to move his division command post up on Edson's Ridge. And he did. And they said, well, this is probably his powers to be. So why, your division staff said, why are you doing this, sir? He says, I want to move out of the V-ring. And then his chief of staff says, and Edson was saying, look, we think the Japanese are going to attack. And if I was the Japanese commander, this is where I would attack. So Vandegrift didn't say, no, that's not how it's going to be. But he was still reluctant because, once again, he had that forward defense. Mm-hmm. He was reluctant to pull any guys, especially off his flanks. He thought those Japanese were going to replicate the Ichiki attack from August and hit them on the right flank on the Ilu River, because that was the quickest way. He says, instead of hitting us, you know, Ichiki with 900, they're going to hit us with 3,000 and push straight through. It's the quickest way. And he was looking at it from a conventional point of view. But Edson and Thomas says, look, these guys, if I was commander, I would go south and come up. And then Vandegrift moved the division headquarters up on the ridge. they started setting in. Once the scouts started coming back and saying the reports are these guys are going into the jungle, then Vandegrift started the pennies drop, so to speak. Okay, they're potentially not going to hit us on the flank. I'm still not going to commit my reserve, which is the 2nd Battalion of the 5th Marines, up on the ridge. I'll hold them back just in case they hit us. But what I'll do is I'll start pulling some of the 105-millimeter howitzers and some of the 75-millimeters back, and we'll start pre-registering in that area.
Yep.
And the way Edson and Thomas sold it to the boss, so to speak, Vandegrift, he says, look, our battalion is my battalion's been hit quite hard over the last month. Instead of us resting in the coconut grove near the airfield where we're getting bombed, can we just go up on the ridge there and have a bit of a rest? And that takes us away from the bombing. Plus also, since, you know, you're set on putting your division command post up there, we can be your security. Right. And Vandegrift said yes. So that was the way, if you read especially the memoirs of Thomas, that's the way they sold it to the old man. They said that the stage was set. So Vandegrift or Edson moved up there, I think, on the 10th of September.
Just a couple of days before, too. And that gave him enough time to, you know, dig some foxholes and clear fields of fire. He started, you mentioned the artillery, and this is huge. Pedro del Valle, who's in charge of the 11th Marines, he's the boss. He comes up and he himself walks the battlefield. I forget who he walks the battlefield with. It maybe it was Edson. I frankly don't recall.
There's a good article in 1943 from the artillery magazine that I read not too long ago that Pedro wrote about that 1943.
Did they register artillery back then like the way they do it today?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah, they had, you know, there's a number of ways you can do it. And they were using a fixed point, and the fixed points was the hills there. And they had the Marines being Marines. Nowadays, even in those days, like the U.S. Army would have hills in elevation. So, example, they use feet instead of meters. But the Marines, they start out in Guadalcanal. The very first hill on Bloody Ridge was Hill 1, then Hill 2, then it just went, they went west in Hill 3. And that's why if you go in the later battles, if you go to Guadalcanal, this is Hill 43, and you're thinking, this hill is like 200 meters high. Was it 43? But that's how the Marines had named it. But yeah, but that's how these. That's one of the ways, and because their maps are so bad, they couldn't use the grid method, so they just use reference off a fixed point.
But the fact that Del Valle went down in there and did that before the event and registered his artillery. Okay, here's point A, B, B, whatever, and does all this is the sign of a hell of a commander, because this, you know, Del Valle, of course, he, like Edson, rises to fame later, but this is huge for the event that's coming, that's going to come forward. Marine artillery, as we're going to see, is probably the savior of those raiders, to be perfectly honest with you. Well, Edson is convinced, you know, that he starts sending out patrols on what, the 11th, I think, or the 12th, I forget.
On the 11th, because on once the 11th. They said, if you read on the 10th, they're going up at a rest area. And on the way, he says, grab all the barbed wire you can. And guys start looking at each other, and you probably interview some of the writers. And if you speak to some of the former writers or read their memoirs, they knew they were in the rest area because they said writers never rest. But I think they were up there for something like 5 or 6 hours resting. Then he says, okay, company commander started getting orders and grab up there and grab your barbed wire. They didn't have any entrenching tools, hardly. And on Bloody Ridge, especially if you see some of my videos, the ridge itself is made of coral, like a lot of the ridges on Guadalcanal. So topsoil is maybe not even a foot in most places. So you can dig down a foot quite easy, then you hit coral. So most of the guys were just putting scrapes in, so to speak. And you can see after the battle, especially some of the Thal Sul, he took a lot of good photos. You could see some of the shell scrapes in there. So they didn't have like deep foxholes like they did later. But yeah, he sent a lot of patrols out initially to try to find these Japanese active patrolling.
Well, it doesn't take them long to make contact with the enemy, the raiders, that is, make contact with the enemy. Because, they're probing and they're hitting Japanese here and there. But it's on the, what is it, the, I'm looking at my notes here, late night on the 12th. So this is the day after. 2 days after the raiders have been there, that there's firefights starting with some in the leading elements of the Japanese who are also probing marine lines. And this goes in the late night of the 12th and early morning, I guess you'd want to say, of the 13th. And in between there, and this is when I remember some raiders saying, Sweeney being one, is when they were receiving, John Sweeney, when they were receiving, they started receiving naval artillery on the ridge. And around the ridge, they were like, this probably isn't going to be as restful as we would hope it to be. And this isn't destroyed. Well, there were destroyers. It was the cruiser Sendai.
The cruiser and 2 or 3 destroyer. And then bombing raids. You remember probably the day before, instead of bombing, they were watching it. Okay, here they go. Tojo time. Again, they called the daily bombings around noon. Here they're going to come bomb the airfield. And they were watching it. And instead of dropping the sticks on the airfield, they dropped them on the daisy cutters, as they call them, the ones that explode right above the ground. I think they killed 2 raiders and wounded a number on that day. And they knew, okay, they are coming. It's another sign that potentially they're coming here.
Yeah. So it was not a surprise in any way, shape or form. And we had talked about it at the beginning. The Japanese wanted a coordinated, Kawaguchi wanted a coordinated assault. You know, he wanted to hit him from the flanks and then hit him up right through the gut and just boom, overwhelm him with superior force and run right down into the airfield. And it sounds like a great plan if you could execute it that way.
Coordinate it.
Exactly. If you could coordinate it. And there was virtually no coordination because of lack of communication, poor intel, no maps to speak of, and the jungle, of course. We already talked about all this, but even the guys that got there at relatively the same amount of time, they were late, the Japanese says, they were late in assembling. They weren't even ready to roll when they were supposed to roll, even though they were there when they were supposed to be there. So it kind of, you know, they screw the pooch before they even kick off. You know, I mean, it starts poorly. And on the night of the 13th, the Japanese do launch some attacks on some of the Marines that are down in the jungle at the base of the ridge. Actually, I guess it would be further away from the ridge, wouldn't it, Dave?
Well, no, it's at the base. You got it right. And this is my theory from, I don't know, I think I told you last time, we have 300 visits to the ridge. Mm-hmm. I used to go up there and just read books. So it was near where I used to live. Right. And I studied the ground quite a bit. And the whole point about the Japanese were lost, as in when that attack, they went around the left flank instead of going up the hill. And they didn't know where the ridge was at night, which, yeah, you tend to believe that until you actually walk the ground. And I've walked the ground at night just to see what the Japanese would, how I would think as the Japanese on the base of Bloody Ridge out of that jungle. The front portion of that ridge, Hill 1, is straight up. It is straight up. So as you realize how the Japanese are infiltration attacks, not attacks, if they hit an obstacle, they're going to go around the obstacle. Mm-hmm. So you come out of that jungle at night, and that hill's straight up. And especially if you know there's Marines on there, you can go around them, you infiltrate around. So a lot of reports state, and a lot of history state, that the Japanese are very, very lost. And that's why they went around that left flank to hit C Company raiders. I think the commander on the scene made that decision to infiltrate around, and according to Japanese techniques and tactics, and plus they hit that obstacle. And if you physically look and straight up, you're not going to go straight up that thing. You're going to go around it.
Right.
So what they did was, yeah, and you mentioned it, they're very uncoordinated. In fact, Kawaguchi was so frustrated, he didn't even, he was just like, he threw his guys in there and he had no control whatsoever. Kawaguchi was in the river, Lunga River, because the jungle was so thick. Part of one of the battalions went into the river, was moving down the river, which is the least path of resistance. Once again, Japanese techniques to infiltrate around, to move quickly. But they got caught in that jungle, and there's two big lagoons. There's only one lagoon there now. And the poor raiders, when they put them in, C Company raiders, was between the Lunga and the ridge. And that's all flat swamp, probably about 200 yards between the river and the ridge. Mm-hmm. B Company of the raiders and B Company of the para was up on the ridge front bit. So when the Japanese infiltrated in on that left flank, there was only one battalion that was actually committed that night. Once again, the other battalion was still in its assembly points, lost, didn't even know which way to go. And it was all kind of confusion, especially in the middle of the night there.
So, but the night of the 12th, 13th morning or whatever, that was Kawaguchi's initial target date for the assault.
Yeah.
And he has to, based on exactly what you just said, he has to rein his people in and say, okay, this is not going to work just yet. Let's try and coordinate as much as we can. But again, this just leads the Marines to start preparing even more for the assault that comes the next night. So this is, while this is no, you know, small threat, the assault that comes 12, 13, it's nothing that like what compares the following or what comes the following night. So much so that the following morning, Edson is, he's sitting up on the ridge, eating his breakfast. And I forget who he's speaking to it might have been just talking to his officers. I frankly don't recall, but he just mumbles, basically says they were just testing, you know, and they'll be back, because he knew, he was no fool, you know, he knew that they got hit by, what would you say, a battalion?
he knew that there was just probing us, and he knew there was roughly 3,000 Japanese out there, and they only hit us with a small amount.
Yeah.
He thought they were probing us, and said what he would do, but he just didn't realize the Japanese were so uncoordinated. That's all they could commit to the attack that night.
Right. But he wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong. So what then that morning, the 13th, which will lead into the 14th, after that initial hit on his lines, again, this goes back to my comment about how smart he was when it came to infantry tactics. He immediately pulls some of those, well, I say immediately, once the sun rises, he starts pulling some of those Marines back out of those lines, and he starts tightening them up around the base of the ridge into new positions, you know, so the Japanese are unfamiliar with the territory again and this sort of thing. And who does he put up there? Do you recall?
Yes. I've studied this one a lot in detail. So what, when I used to give battlefield study tours, I used to give them or battlefield study tour to the military, so the Australian and New Zealand and some Marines. And I always take them to Bloody Ridge and Edson's Ridge, because it's a great study in small unit tactics and reading the ground, because the terrain there looks roughly, it's a well-preserved battlefield. So from a leader's point of view, especially studying terrain and employment of troops, it's a good one to study. So what Edson did, that first night attack the Japanese had, they pushed C Company back. And in the old days, used to call it refused his line. So his line was, he still had two companies up on the, he had a kind of like a defense in depth of three lines. So he had the first line, he still had two companies up there. The C Company had been pushed back. The Japanese were on his flank in the thick jungle. In fact, that morning, he sent a couple of companies to try to push him out, and then the Japanese are so entrenched in there, and he pulled them back. But what he was faced with, he knew the Japanese were going to come with a major assault that night, and he said, if they hit us on the flank, I've got my two forward companies, they'll cut us off, and they'll cut us in half. So what I'll do is, all my guys on my front line, so he's got three lines, I'll pull them back to the second line. So if you look at, especially if you look at my videos, you can see there's three spurs on Bloody Ridge. There's the first one, Hill 1. Then there's a middle spur, which doesn't have a name. Then you got Hill 2, which is the Edson's command post hill, the final hill. Or if you want to put him in feet, there's Hill 90. Then Edson's is 120. So he had B Company, Sweeney, under Sweeney's B Company in the middle. And he had B Company of the Paramarines and C Company on his left. If you look at that spur, if you walk the spur, it's a good little defensive position. But unfortunately, he had one of his B platoons down in the thick jungle. And because he couldn't keep a continuous line, didn't have enough men, he had a small outpost. He had a platoon-sized outpost covering his jungle trails, like an all-around defense. And he had two lines. And at that stage, these guys always gets left out of the battle. Engineers. Mm-hmm. He had a whole platoon of engineers, and he had the pioneers, which are like combat engineers. They were on the other side of the river, and he had some of those guys. And he also had some of the engineers backed by the division command post. And he had 2-5 still in reserve. They hadn't been committed yet, so Vandegrift wasn't going to commit them. But what Edson did was amazing. When he pulled that front line back, it opened up a killing space of, he pulled them back about 200 yards, 200 to 300 yards, but it opened up the open ground of 200 to 300 yards of killing spots. So the Japanese still thought the Marines were on top of that hill. And then the 105s had knew that first hill. So there are pre-registered on the hill. So he had a good position. He had a nice tight position. Then he basically said, look, if we need to fall back, he had fallback plans, we'll all fall back to the final hill. That's our final protective line, so to speak, like they call it in military FPF. And we'll form a horseshoe shape around the final hill. So he could re-terrain very quickly. He can adapt to the situation very quickly.
Which is, of course, what they wind up having to do. It's that fair thing, exactly what you said.
But did this go flawlessly for the Marines?
No.
We talked a lot about the Japanese mistakes and bad decisions.
The prepping to the big event, the Marines do everything that they're supposed to do, you know, like it's a pre-register artillery, you know, like Dave said, pulling them back into this killing field. Say again.
They brought ammunition and
right,
thousands of grenades.
Yeah, it's grenades out the wazoo. And, you know, they're ready to go. But I mean, they're just, again, just as you said, Dave, they're too few with too much ground to cover. The Marines are, you know, and he breaks them up into, Edson breaks them up into small groups of guys because that's all they can do. And there is no continuous line of defense. And that is what, frankly, kind of almost, and he, not his fault, man could only do what he could do with what he had, but that kind of, you know, that doesn't bode well for the impending attack. So around 1830 that night, the first attacks begin, Japanese attacks. And they hit Company B and Company D hard, really hard. Specifically B, and this is Sweeney's people. They hit them really, really, really hard. And they punched through, and they being the Japanese, punched through, and they surged through the gap in the lines in between the two companies at that point. And it kind of goes to hell in a handbasket pretty quick, doesn't it, Dave?
Oh, yes, yes. And some of the on the left flank, the riders with some of the paramarine guys, and they started pulling back. Without telling Sweeney. So Sweeney's company was basically left on that middle knoll by itself. So no one on the left flank, the Japanese had penetrated his right flank, and he was still standing there until Barak, which was Edson's runner, Corporal Barak, one of his right-hand men, basically had to go down physically, run down and yell at him to move back.
So the you mentioned B Company, but we'll talk about B Company paramarines here briefly. Edson at one point, so the B Company of the Paramarines, they get hit just as hard as B Company Raiders do, and probably a little bit harder, frankly. He at one point, Edson, I think after the event, I got it written down here, he estimated that at around 2,200 hours, so this is about 3.5 hours, the Japanese launched their first assault, B Company, and this is Paramarines, B Company of the Raiders and two small groups of paramarines, about 300 guys total, are facing two full battalions of Japanese.
Yes, yes. So once again, and we'll probably mention at the very end, only two battalions of Japanese. Kawaguchi had three battalions, mm-hmm. and only really two battalions that whole night was committed. The elements of the third was committed, and that was a big kind of, I don't like to do the what ifs, but Kawaguchi said if he could have committed that third battalion, which is his largest battalion, probably could have punched through. So his largest battalion wasn't committed for the whole battle because a number of factors, command and control and confusion, they were out of the battle. So, yeah, so basically at that stage, I wouldn't say they were facing two full battalions, but they were the only Marine, the two battalion assault, they were the only Marines going against it. It probably, the Japanese would rush companies at a time. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like 800 guys rushed at once, and so it was 200 guys who committed when they fire their fires and rushes.
I think what I'd like people to understand about this battle specifically is that it wasn't like boom and over. I mean, this went on for hours and hours and hours. Like I said, the Japanese launched their first assaults that night about 1830. So about 2200, this is, several hours later, and the fighting is still going on. It's not raging, every minute of that time, but it's pretty damn consistent, and it's getting closer and closer, because we talked about it. The Japanese did punch through the Marine lines there at one point, and, there's guys that are cut off, there's guys that are surrounded, and one of the things that we mentioned earlier, this is one of the first times it really comes into play, is that as those Japanese are breaking through that line, and they're beating feet, they're moving, Marine artillery, comes in there and holds them down for quite a while. And at this point, this is when the runner comes and pulls Sweeney's people out, or tells them to get out at this point, is it not? If I've got my timeline straight in my head.
Yeah, it's what the Japanese had done. When Sweeney got cut off, he wasn't going to move back to Hill 2, to the last position. They had field phone wires, they didn't have radios, they had field phones with wires. The Japanese had got on the field phone, and he said, at one stage, Edson calls Sweeney, says, what's your situation, how's it going? And someone in perfect English came on and says, oh, the situation is fine here, sir. And Sweeney said, oh, the Japanese are on our lines. So the only way they could get him back, each one of them had code names, like Red Mike was obviously Edson's, and I forgot what Sweeney's was, but Barak was later killed in action on Guadalcanal, but Barak was Edson's runner, main runner, and he was like one of his trusted guys. So he runs down and he yells out whatever the code name, just say jumping gym or whatever. And he yells out to Sweeney. He says, Red Mike said it's okay to move back. He goes, this is Barack. He goes, Red Mike said it's okay to move back. And he yells out. Mm-hmm. And he goes, okay. So they started moving back. And just, they were on the, and I know exactly where his command post was. I've been there many a time, just on that middle spur. If you look at my video, the middle spur, Guadalcanal, that's it. And Sweeney and his small command group moved down the road. They're running down the road on the ridge road. They're moving back down that road and picking up Raiders. And during, that was a thing, a bit confusion for the Marines. They had B Company on one side, and they used the road as the line to delineate the two units. So on the left side of the road was the para guys, and right side with the Raiders. So you had two B companies right beside each other. So they're yelling out, you know, was it Baker? Baker Company was a World War II B Company. Baker with me, and they didn't know which Baker it was.
Right.
So it was a Baker para, Baker Raider. So there's a bit of confusion in there. But they all made it back. In fact, there was one story, I forgot what veteran, he says he's moving back down the road. He says, I was a bit delayed and I jumped out of the bushes. He says, I'm running down the road and, you know, a number of Marines with me were running down the road to get back to Hill 2. And I look around, there's they're Japanese. And he's running in with the Japanese squad. He's in the middle of them. He said, because it's so dark and it's confusing. And he's just so, he goes, I looked around, I went straight back into the bushes and rode down the hill and made my way back. He says, he looked around, he goes, these aren't Marines, these are Japanese. I mean, it was quite funny, I guess, at the time. He's like, my God, it shows how confusing it was in the middle of the dark. It's just amazing.
But it also shows how close the fighting was, too. Oh, yeah. I mean, if you're getting up and you're withdrawing to another position, and all of a sudden you're in the midst of the enemy and you're trucking along with them, this is some close fighting. And speaking of withdrawing, when Sweeney's people and B Company paras who are under, I think at this time, their original company commander had been relieved, and Torgerson of Raggedy Ass Marines was a battalion commander.
Yeah, it was a guy called Miller.
Okay.
And so, Edson said he was a dud because he yelled for him. He was still in his hoe, and he's told Torgerson, you're in charge.
Torgerson, this is the guy that we talked about in the last episode, but, you know, raggedy ass Marine, you know, where he blows his pants off and everything else. But to Torgerson, he goes in there, you know, the whole losing his pants thing is not his most glorious moment, obviously, but he goes in there and he does his thing, does he not?
Yeah, so basically they were pushed back on the left flank, and there was a small ravine there. And the Japanese were in that ravine ready to do an attack. So Torgi, as they called him, Torgerson, Edson says, take your guys and get them out of there. So he runs and he tries to get the elements of these two companies. When I said a company in the paramarines, that stage are roughly about a platoon size, only about 40, 50 guys. So he managed to get about 50 guys up. He says, fix bayonets. And they did roughly, they got on line, the skirmish line, and went straight down there's a small incline straight into the ravine and hit the Japanese straight on and pushed the Japanese back. And the Japanese moved back, and they didn't do any more assaults up that ravine. And then the paramarines held that small portion of the line.
Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain, that Little Round Top kind of stuff right there, Jack.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
That's serious cojones in the middle of a fight like this. So when, again, I briefly mentioned it, but when the Raiders are pulling back, withdrawing to a point, and they're actually, I don't believe anybody ever used that word withdraw, but somebody said something about withdraw, and the Marines start to run. Like some of them are, they're not running, they're being
quick time march kind of thing.
They're hauling ass.
Attack to the rear, yeah.
Yeah, attack to the rear, exactly. They are getting the hell out of there to a point where the withdrawal, which is what it was, tactical withdrawal, is rapidly becoming a rout. Like some of these Marines, they're running. They're scared and they're running.
Rout as in killed, or rout as in they ran away? And
both.
They were trying to move up the field.
Yeah. So this is where one of your favorite Marines comes into play here, Kenneth Bailey. What does Ken Bailey do here?
Well, I'll take a couple of steps back. So there was, all through the night, there was a few Marines. Obviously, these guys, you get to remember, these Raiders had been up for 48, 72 hours. They've been fighting quite hard. So they're, even though they're the elite troops, they're almost at the breaking point, so to speak. And at one stage, the Japanese, when they would fire their flares off, magnesium flares, And they were using them for obviously to light the area up and also for guiding. That, like Sweeney said, the Japanese flares would hit the ridge and that would serve as a guide point for all the other Japanese to attack, like an attack point. Mm-hmm. But these flares gave off a particular smell. Then at one stage, the Japanese letting smoke pots off to try to mask it. So you got the smoke pot, the confusion, and there's all kind of different factors. Apparently, the Japanese word for charge sounds like gas for some reason. Right. And someone, whether it's Japanese or Marines, started yelling out gas attack, that caused a little more of the panic. And they started moving out. And at this stage, you had Bailey. Now, Bailey was wounded in the thigh, which we mentioned last week at Tulagi. Right. And he was sent to New Caledonia to the hospital. So him and another Marine officer, Raider officer, said, we need to go back. And he said, well, you're not going back. And they said, well, yes, we are. So they went AWOL, hitched a flight, because the flights were coming into Guadalcanal at that stage, and he hitched a flight, and they landed. Because at that stage, he was giving briefings and giving talks to the U.S. Army in New Caledonia about the fight in Guadalcanal. Mm-hmm. He said, I need to go back to my guys. So they land there, I think on the 12th, and he makes his way. He says, where's the Raiders? And he's all up on that ridge. So he makes his way there, and he's still wearing his hospital shoes, tennis shoes, apparently. So he gets up there, and Bailey's a former all-star football player, big man. So Bailey was normally the company commander of C Company. So C Company already had the commander. They got hit hard the first night, so they were kind of behind the thing. And Edson says, I'm glad to have you back. I'm not giving you company command. You can just stay with me and just assist me. Samuel Griffin was the XO, but Bailey was kind of like the second executive officer. So during the course of the battle, Bailey and Edson both, when they see some of the Marines moving back, Bailey was physically throwing guys back in a hole. One stage, Bailey had his 45 out, threatening to shoot people. Edson was yelling at them, shaming them, because one of the biggest ways you can get back to Marines is to shame them. He said, you call yourself Marines. And I think Edson was yelling out points at one stage. He said, the one thing that you have, the Japanese have one thing you don't have is guts. Mm-hmm. You know, get in your holes. If you need to die in your holes, you're going to die in your holes. We're the only things that's stopping the Japanese from taking the airfield. And once they take the airfield, it's all over for all of us. I think one stage before the battle, he said, you know, if we don't defeat these, we'll be the guys out there in the jungles eating coconuts. He says, defend, we're the last men. And Bailey was, you speak to all the veterans, you speak to many people. He was everywhere, all running all through the battle. Someone says, Bailey, oh, Bailey was with me, give me ammunition. Oh, no, Bailey was on the other side of the battlefield, bringing me a machine gun. Or Bailey was in the middle, you know, helping us out, giving us words of encouragement. In fact, Bailey was wounded during that battle, too. He was shot in the helmet. He had a bullet hole in his helmet and had a slight graze to his scalp. So Bailey was, and he's also making runs back, getting ammunition. In some of, they called them I forgot what vehicles, but basically Jeeps. Mm-hmm. And moving back and getting Jeeps and making a run. So the 1st Marine Regiment donated, I forgot how many thousands of grenades and ammunition, because I know that the Raiders getting hit hard. But yeah, Bailey was very, very instrumental and Edson of keeping that line together by their own personal leadership, example, and physical force.
Yeah, just tenacity and brute strength at some points.
Yeah.
The entire time this is going down, that the Marines are running, and they are, they're running, and Bailey and Edson and probably, you know, several dozen other guys who are unnamed
NCOs
are throwing, literally, physically throwing these people back into their holes and making them form their line. Pedro Davalle's artillery is kicking that ass all night long. They are dropping the artillery all over the ridge where these Marines had just run from. Those 105s are dropping all over that area, and they are eating the Japanese alive. It Richard Tregaskis, who wrote the book, which is a fantastic book, Guadalcanal Diary. They made it into a movie that was not as good as the book, but he was a correspondent, of course, on the island, and he was in the headquarters with Vandegrift, I believe, at this moment, or very near there.
Yeah.
And he personally overheard the radio, and it's one of the coolest, you know, little transmissions that you'll hear. And he said, Tregaskis wrote this, and he said, all I could hear over the radio was, quote, drop it 50, walk it back and forth across the ridge. And the Marine artillery is doing that very thing. They're just going boom, 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 back and forth across that ridge. And they're beating a pattern into that ground. And it is just devastating. The Japanese are coming up because, like you said earlier, they got nowhere to hide. You know, they're, you know, what little depressions in the ground they can get, you know, they're taking that. But I mean, that's not going to do a whole hell of a lot to, for a 105 shell. And then they're in that killing field that you talked about that had pulled them back. So, I mean, these guys are just getting hammered by this artillery. And Edson, I believe he sent a runner back to Del Valle, or maybe Del Valle sent a runner to Edson or something. I don't remember anymore. Maybe you do. That Edson said, you know, keep it up because it's knocking the hell out of them. And that's exactly what they did, is they fired something like 1,350 rounds.
No, more than that.
Well, in the span of an hour, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, they were just ripping it. I mean, they were just blowing the hell out of them. And I mean, you know, while the individual bravery of the Marines that were in those foxholes, or whatever you wanted to call them, is obviously, you know, the hand-to-hand fighting is, and it does break down into that, the artillery really saves their bacon. And it saves really the whole airfield, you know, at this point, because there was not much stopping the Japanese from punching through the rest of that line and rolling down that air, rolling down that hill to the airfield like a wave.
The Japanese started with 5,000, right?
Ish, roughly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ish,
yeah. And how many do you think have been attrited at this point by this, by the point where they're getting hit by this artillery?
That's very hard to tell. I don't know, Dave, maybe you know.
So roughly he had 3,000 on the fields, because you got to remember the 5,000 or up to 6,000 was also the guys on the in flank. The
jungle.
He had two of flanks attacks.
Right.
So at this stage of the battlefield, I mean, we'll probably talk about it at the end. I mean, there's no fixed exact count for the Japanese, but there's roughly 800 it's attributed to the battle of deaths. So I'd say they were – I don't know. It's hard to tell. That's, who knows? They've been hit quite hard. And talking about the artillery, we mentioned about how the reference points calling in artillery. At one stage, it wasn't being called in. It didn't have any forward observers. So what they were doing was, the last known, they were just telling the artillery batteries, the fire direction control center, just said, the last salvo you fired, drop 50 from that or drop 100 from that. And at one stage, If you go up on hill two, you can see that's where the Edson command post was, the last stand, so to speak, especially the 75 millimeters, because they brought a whole battery of 75s, about two ridges over, probably about 500-600 yards behind them. And they were firing almost straight up and straight down. So what they were doing is 50 yards in intervals, and they're just moving them back and forth in the flat. Back and forth and up and down the ridge line. If you look at the photos of Bloody Ridge from that time into this day, there's a road that runs on the ridge, and they were just walking up and down that road, because the Japanese at one stage are running full speed down that road. There's some good photos of dead Japanese. Well, I'm saying good photos, you right. know what I mean? But there's the photos are good, well quality, but there's dead Japanese all up and down that road. You can see when hit with machine gun fire and mainly artillery fire. There was three attributes how the Marines won this, contributed to three things, this battle. One was artillery. Two was the Cactus Air Force, how they almost wiped out a whole battalion in the barges. And then we'll see a bit later when they strafed these guys. And the tenacity of the Marines itself and the leadership.
Leadership, yep.
So the artillery, without the artillery, though, they wouldn't have made it. I think it was in this battle or another one. One of the Japanese officers said the Marines had automatic artillery.
And he was serious. This one.
All the Marines had automatic artillery. Yeah. I know that the 105s fired over 2,000 rounds alone, and that's not counting the 75 millimeter howitzers. A lot of artillery.
A tremendous amount of art, like World War One style artillery here. But even that didn't stop the Japanese. It certainly stopped them for a minute, but they still kept coming, and the fighting got so close. This is where, you know, we talk about hand-to-hand, you talk about grenades, you know, thousands of grenades, is that as Edson had pulled his people back to that horseshoe section on the hill, the last stand, if you will, the Marines are up there and they can hear the Japanese massing down at the bottom of the hill, or it might have been up on the other slope of the other, but regardless of this, the Marines are actually rolling they're not even throwing, they're just rolling the grenades down the line. and that they're exploding in the midst of the Japanese before they're coming up. And then the Japanese are coming in and they're getting in the hand-to-hand fighting. Japanese get so close that they're actually taking rifle shots at Vandegrift's command post. And it's, you know, it's touch and go, man. It's damn near go at this point. It's close. It's close. And it goes all the way all night long. It goes all night long, all the way into the wee hours of the morning, and it doesn't stop there. What they're clinging. The Marines are clinging to Victor. They're clinging by the skin of their teeth at this point. But as the sun rises, the tide, you know, inexorably changes in favor of the United States Marine Corps, because you just talked about it. You know, some of the P-400s, I believe some of the Wildcats take off, that Dauntless. Don't lie. We've talked about this before. Pluralized Dauntless. They take off and they're starting to chew what's left of the Japanese up. And it's at this point, it's kind of a done deal. But even then, there's still pockets of Japanese in and around the ridge, close to the command post. There's a story about, I can't think of the guy's name. He's berating a Marine.
Banta.
Yeah. What's that story there?
Yeah, there's a few different stories about it, but if you read whatever account, like Tregaskis was there, Millett, which was a historian and press officer, then you had Sewell, they're all in the command post. And Vandegrift, to his credit, he established his command post on the ridge, and he stayed there the whole time during the battle. There was Japanese sniper fire all through the course of the fight, and they were and machine gun fire. There was was it Tregaskis? He mentions that he got under machine gun fire and he went to the other side of the slope and laid under a log all night and didn't move from there because the Japanese were firing a machine gun at him. So he says, I'm a correspondent. I'm not getting involved in this. But in Twining's book, he mentions a lot of this too. So basically the story was Sergeant Major Banta, which is a character in itself, was a division sergeant major, later to be a warrant officer. So he's in the division command post berating a Marine for something, what sergeant majors do right after the battle in the morning time, in the daylight hours. And apparently there was a Japanese officer and two Japanese enlisted guys running. They're not in the tent, but they're outside the tent, as the story goes. And Vandegrift is only 30 feet away. So they're running. There's two versions. I tend to believe that the bayonet with a rifle rather than the sword. And there's a couple of versions where a Japanese officer throws his sword and kills a gunnery sergeant. And I forgot the gunnery sergeant's name. At the door of a tent, and he falls down. I just don't see him throwing a sword.
No.
And another one where a guy with a bayonet, he kind of throws his rifle in a bayonet potentially. But anyway, however that happened, there was one Marine that went down. And then Sergeant Major Banta apparently takes his 45 off and shoots offhand. He was yelling at this Marine, and he turns around and kills one Japanese, knocks him down. The other Japanese gets knocked down by another Marine, and Banta apparently runs over with his 45 and sticks it to his head and shoots him in the head. And the other Japanese runs off into the jungle. And all this happened within 30 feet of the division commander. It was something like in the movie with Mel Gibson and Sam Elliott movie, you know, the Vietnam movie, where they charge a command post and Sergeant Major defending them. But there, that would actually happen. It's been verified a number of times. It's just.
Did the Sergeant Major continue yelling at the Marine after he finished?
Probably. Yeah, I would say yes. I don't know if it's been, you know, the stories, but it's a good story. Of course he did. You know, he just holstered his 45 and kept on chewing the Marine because that's what sergeant majors do.
Indeed. Indeed they do. Indeed. But, you know, that's the end of the main assault. That's the, you know, I mean, that specific event not necessarily is, but that morning the assault peters out, you know, Kawaguchi, but that's not the end of the battle though either. Because the Japanese do hit the Marine lines over the next few days in various spots. The Kuma Battalion makes an appearance, but it's not anything like it was supposed to have been. And by that, I mean, you know, the further Japanese assaults.
And what happens to Edson, Dave?
Well, Edson, yeah, he obviously survives the battle. then trying to think which exact day. Well, anyway, within 10 days, he's given command, because after the Battle of Edson's Ridge, there was a major shakeup in the 1st Marine Division. Some of these older regimental commanders who might have been good in their younger days, but they were deemed to be not as aggressive as some of the younger commanders. So one of the commanders was Colonel Hunt, which is probably rated as the best combat officer in the Great War, but I think he was one war too many.
The same kind of thing happened in the submarine force in World War II, by the way, where less aggressive captains were replaced.
Yeah, with the younger, more aggressive ones. And that's what happened. Exactly. So Edson was given command of the 5th Marine Regiment. And he took command of the 1st 5th Marines after that.
At what point did they award him the Medal of Honor?
He was given it in Australia. I think he was obviously recommended for it by Vandegrift. For that battle. And then they were all awarded, the majority of them were awarded their actual medals. In fact, all of them awarded the medals in Australia in one big ceremony.
On the cricket grounds, wasn't it?
43, yeah, in Balmoral, near Melbourne, Balmoral ground.
After the Army battlefield for the Marines.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
But Edson, I mean, if there was anybody who was deserving of the Medal of Honor for this action, it's Merritt Edson. And Bailey gets it too for this medal, but Bailey does not live to actually physically receive it. When does Kenneth Bailey meet his end?
On the 27th of September, so roughly 2 weeks later. Bailey was, when Edson took over the 5th Marine Regiment, Samuel Griffin became, he was the XO at the time, he became the battalion commander, and Bailey became the executive officer of the 1st Marine Raiders. So when the 7th Marines landed on the 18th, gave Vandegrift a bit of a force to go on the offensive. So he was running an active defense, so to speak. So it's called the Second Battle of Matanikau on the 27th, which was probably the only defeat the Marines had on the island. So during that battle, Bailey was leading from the front as always, and he was shot by a Japanese machine gun in the face, and he died. And Samuel Griffin was wounded too. So in that fight, the only Marine Raider to actually die was Bailey. So he didn't live to see the medal.
Yeah. But he also was one who was well deserving of the award. So to wrap it up, which is what we're going to do here, the assessment of this event, this is a multi-day deal. We talked about the attacks. We talked about some of the personal stories within the attack. But, the bottom line of this whole thing is that the Marines hang on, obviously, but just barely. I mean, just freaking barely do they hang on. The Japanese break their lines a couple of times, they punch through. Bill, you'd mentioned the artillery and what the artillery, how many casualties, or what the attrition rate was for the Japanese at this point. While we don't necessarily know, and nobody really does know the exact figures, Rich Frank had a figure that I pulled out for this. It's estimated that the artillery, Pedro de Valle's artillery, the 11th Marines, killed no less than 2/3, but no more than 3/4. How they came up with that figure, I do not know. Probably by the shape of the bodies, but who the hell knows? Of the Japanese that were killed at Bloody Ridge / Edson's Ridge. So, I mean, the artillery is really, it stopped at least, three major assaults by the Japanese, the artillery did?
Oh, yeah, at one stage, and they were stopping the Japanese before they even begin their assaults in the assembly areas.
Right.
There was one story where one of the forward observers could hear, they're directing their fire by screams. When they hear a large amount of Japanese screams, they would just say, fire for effect, pour it on there. And I've read one Japanese account, he said his whole company was basically wiped out before they even started their assault by effective American artillery.
Yeah. I mean, that's a perfect word for it, a phrase for it, effective American artillery to the nth degree. Another thing that factored into the American victory here, Dave, you talked about it before, was the air support, and not just the morning after, but leading up to it. It eliminated a whole battalion, not just on the barges, but too, they're getting assaulted from the air as they're moving down the beach trail. Are they not? Yeah. So I mean,
another battalion of the 4th Regiment had also landed. Mm-hmm. See, beforehand, Kawaguchi was offered another battalion. And he says, no, I don't need another battalion. I can do this. I can do what I've got. Yeah. So yeah, the air power decimated a lot of the guys before we even got to the fight.
And then, you know, of course, you know, we talked about the bravery and the expert tactical sense of Edson and the bravery of Bailey and Edson too, for that matter, and the individual Marines, John Sweeney, or, you know, people like that, Torgerson, you know, that ultimately, you know, with the artillery or without the artillery, if you don't have boots on the ground, guys pulling triggers, it's going to fail regardless. At the end of the day, you know, the lion's share of the victory falls on the shoulders of the Raiders and the paramarines and the pioneers that were down in there. And it's,
and I'd say one thing, Seth, it gets left out a lot of times. The 2nd Battalion, the 5th Marines,
2-5, yeah,
they're the guys. Yeah, 2-5 was the guys that they held back. At one stage during the battle, Edson and Bailey, because Bill Whaling, one of my friends is waiting for the book on Bill Whaling. He's almost a legend. He's the guy that formed the scouts and snipers there. But he was battalion command. So he was battalion commander. And they're yelling out, Bill Whaling, Edson and Bailey and the rest of the Raiders yelling it out. Actually, come up. And they committed his battalion probably early in the morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning. But they only could send one company up at a time. In fact, G Company was moving up and it got hit by a Japanese ambush. And they lost, they had 30 casualties right off the bat before he even reached the ridge. But 2-5 is normally left out in most accounts. Mm. I mean, I was up on the ridge one day and I just seen an older couple standing there. I went, okay, I'll go and have a chat to him as I always do. And his dad was in 2-5. And he just said, look, I don't know what happened here. So I had to tell him about what happened in 2-5. But 2-5 normally gets left out. And the engineers too, they were, there was a whole platoon of Japanese that made it through and overran some of the engineers behind the division command post and took a couple of machine guns. And then the other company of engineers had to do a small counterattack and wipe them out. There's a story, I haven't verified it real quick, that the Japanese were given, I guess, orders. When you make it to the airfield, this is what you do, assembly areas. And I think one of their assembly areas were at the end of the airfield. And this was Fighter One. And Fighter One was being built. And that was right before Henderson. That was right at the base of the command post. So some Japanese had made it to the end of Fighter One. And the morning, I don't know, later in the morning, apparently there was 3 or 4 Japanese sitting at the end of the runway, just sitting there on the ground. Because that was their orders. Their orders are, you make it there, just wait for the rest of us. And I don't know if they were either killed or surrendered or whatever, but that's just typical of the Japanese, that, you know, okay, that centralized command and no initiative.
I'd go out on a limb and assume that they probably did not make it off the edge of that airfield. No. So as the Japanese are, this is by far, I mean, granted, we've had, you know, several clashes with the Japanese on the army on the Guadalcanal land campaign so far. But this is by far the closest that we come to defeat. And, you know, I know the battle for Henderson Field, the Japanese, of course, and we'll get to that at a different stage. So, you know, we know that the Japanese break the lines again, you know, several times in the October battle for Henderson Field. But this is, I mean, they're within yards of the airfield at Bloody Ridge, at Edson's Ridge. And I mean, this is, you know, as close as they come to, in my opinion, close as they come to achieving their goal here. And it's, you know, this is one of the more harrowing episodes of the Guadalcanal land campaign.
Yeah, well, I think he's probably the best historians on Guadalcanal, overall historians on Guadalcanal, is Richard Frank.
Oh, yeah.
And Richard's book, especially the Guadalcanal book, and Richard mentions this is probably the closest time the Marines came to losing the campaign. A number of people, because I posted on my Facebook site before, there's the picture, I got a number of pictures of Edson's Ridge and its proximity to the airfield. And the many comments I get back is saying, I didn't know how close it was. I didn't know how close those two are. And if you ever go to Guadalcanal, when you're flying into the Honiara International Airport, which is Henderson Field, you'll look to the right and you'll see a Bloody Ridge. It's only 1,000 yards away.
Yeah.
It's only 1,000 yards. Very, very close.
Too damn close.
So the Marines didn't have much reserves at that stage. They didn't have any reserves. They'd committed their own reserves. So it's a, you know, it's a very problematic if they'd reached the airfield with thousands of Japanese, especially when they had other Japanese ready to come in as reinforcements.
Right.
So, you know, the Marines, I don't know if they've been defeated, but they'd have had a hard time trying to fight back from that.
It would not have been good.
The division command post would have been overran too. So all your command and control would have been wiped out, and it would have been mass confusion. And then all the guys have been piecemeal. So who knows?
Yeah. I really do firmly believe that this, I agree with you 100%. And I know Rich rather well, very well. And I agree with him 100% that this is as close as the Marines came to losing this campaign on the ground anyway, is right here on these two, well, specifically that one night, 13, 14, September, 1942. One of the things that comes after this, though, is the Japanese, once they realize that Kawaguchi has been defeated, they make the critical decision, the Japanese do, to throw everything at Guadalcanal. They know that, they realize that this is not going to be, you know, the easy target that we had.
The emperor even gets involved, right? The emperor's, and there's very few times where the emperor said, this is what I expect. And this is one of those times.
This is indeed. And this is, you know, we always talk about the turning point. We had those three episodes about Midway, you know, and said that Midway was not the turning point, but Guadalcanal was. This moment, at least on the land, in my opinion, is the turning point of the campaign. Because, I mean, this is not saying that we're going to win from here on in, you know, but the fact that the Japanese make the commitment to throw everything that they can at this campaign, be it on the land, on the seas, or in the air, this is the sausage grinder that John Parshall talks about. This is the meat grinder that I talk about. This is the battle of attrition that the Japanese ultimately cannot win. And this is, in my opinion, their decision after Kawaguchi's defeat to throw everything they have at Guadalcanal, this is it, man. This seals their fate right here.
Yeah, it had major ramifications. And because I have two, feet in both sides of the door, as in Australia and America, Americans normally see Guadalcanal standalone. Australians see Kokoda, the Guinea campaign as standalone. But this had major ramifications for the Port Moresby campaign.
Yeah.
Because what it did was, at that stage, before Port Moresby was the main objective for the Japanese. Guadalcanal was just the side objective. But once the line was drawn in the sand and, okay, this is where we're going to fight our decisive battle by the, I think it was emergency meeting of the Imperial Japanese High Command a day or two after when the word got back.
Yep.
And with the emperor and everything coming in. And I think they said, okay, they've drawn a line in the sand. They want to fight the decisive attritional battle here. Let's do it. So they basically told the guys in Port Moresby, hold in place or do a rear withdrawal. Mm-hmm. I think they were started to do that before this because Guadalcanal was starting to be such a major. But then they said, this stage, Port Moresby isn't our main objective. Guadalcanal is going to be our main objective. Hold fast on New Guinea. But that allowed the Australians to kind of regroup, get the regular troops in and start to fight back to Bina and Gona. And later you'll see with the Americans assisting with the 32nd. But that's, I see it from both sides. Yeah. And the Japanese thought both campaigns were a single campaign. I like to think that too. On the Allied side, I'd see Papua New Guinea and Guadalcanal is the same campaign, even though the powers to be at the time didn't look at it that way. They should have. Right. Especially with MacArthur on the left and Nimitz on the right. But the Japanese thought it was a single campaign, but that was a major turning point, like you said.
Yeah.
Battle of Bloody Ridge.
Well, you'll see as we continue this series on Guadalcanal, you'll see you being the listener or watcher or whatever, however you're viewing or hearing this, the level of Japanese intensity when it comes to their attacks in terms of numbers on land, aircraft in the air and ships and at sea, and not just the number of ships, but the types of ships and things that they send. They start sending carriers out the wazoo down there, of course, in October at Santa Cruz. You get several more surface battles on at sea. We start sending, you know, what carriers we have, which are few and far between. And then, of course, we send the battle wagons out there. And then, you know, the army comes in. So, I mean, this is it. This is the sausage grinder. This is the meat grinder.
And, of course, the Tokyo Express is feeding this fire with more and more and more Japanese troops coming ashore. And so the Japanese lose the little battle. And their decision is to send in troops that are also going to get decimated.
Chewed up.
And it's not like they had an alternative. They might have picked other strategies to gain victory, but they had to join the battle here.
Yeah. Yeah. They did not have a choice. Well, I mean, I guess ultimately they did, but this is the fate that they choose, and this is the route that they decide they're going to take. Well, gentlemen, I personally feel that that's a pretty good way to wrap it up. What do you guys think? Do you have anything else you want to add, Dave or Bill?
I've been too talkative today.
No, we were limited. Yeah, no, Bill just can't get a word in. No, I know we're limited for time. I could talk all day, but yeah, that's. I think we've hit the main points of the Battle of Edson's Ridge, and I can't really think of anything.
And this might be our longest episode ever, is it, Seth?
Well, we're pushing the limit. Yeah, we're getting there. Well, we've also recorded for several minutes before we actually recorded, but regardless of this, Dave, we'd love to have you come back and join me. There's still some more land battles we want to talk about, and you know, obviously Henderson Field being one. We'd like to hit on like Point Cruz and, you know, Puller's debacle out there, you know, and different things like that.
Chesty Puller, what they're talking about. Yeah.
Love to have you back if you'd be willing to join us again.
I'm always happy, and you know, I enjoy these talks, and I really like to talk about some of the myths of Guadalcanal.
Bring it on, man.
That would be
bring
good.
I know you guys are
about that's my myth. Sweet spot. Yeah, we're about all about myths here.
Yeah,
there's a few out there.
And there's quite a few, and that's, you know. Again, we're trying to give good history here. So talking about that kind of stuff and you know, debunking that sort of thing, that falls into that category. Mm-hmm. Well, with that being said, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast, wherever you receive your podcasts. Check us out on YouTube. The name of our YouTube page is, ironically enough, the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. If you want to see our video version, we have all of our videos up there. Every single one of our episodes are on that same YouTube channel. Also, please do check out Dave's Facebook page and his YouTube channel. Dave, give us a little rundown on that one more time.
Yeah, it's both for called Guadalcanal, Walking the Battlefield, especially the videos and discussion we had today on Bloody Ridge. I have 3 episodes just along with Bloody Ridge, and then have another episode on the relics of Bloody Ridge, and I really walk you through on the ground. I'm giving you a tour, so
it's absolutely fascinating, and it's definitely on my bucket list of places to go. Who knows? It would damn sure be cool. But if you have a question or a comment, please send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. And you're going to see Dave again, and you're not going to get rid of Bill or I. So with that, I want to say thank you very much for listening, Bill.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. See you next time. And thanks for listening.
Dave, thanks again, man. And we'll see you next time. Yeah. All right, guys. And well, thank you all again for listening, and we'll see you soon.